6,000 species of trees.
Parshias dealing with Malachas HaMishkan, and Tzav is really a continuation of it. I just wanted to go weiter with some of the Inyanim of the Mishkan. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives Moshe Rabbeinu the Tzivoy to make the different parts of the Mishkan, so the first thing that is mentioned is the Aron, then the other things are mentioned. So the Kli Yakor points out that the verb that is used for the construction of the Aron is different than everything else. For every other Kli, and for the Mishkan as a whole, the Tzivoy is Belashen V'asisa, you shall make. Now the you is either Moshe or Bezalel. The Aron is V'asu, they shall make. The Aron HaKadosh is the only one that's V'asu. And the Kli Yakor says, because the Aron represents the idea of Talmud Torah. Now the Rambam writes that Klal Yisrael has three kesarim, three crowns, the keser of Malchus, the keser of Kahuna, and the keser of Torah. And the keser of Malchus belongs to Aaron. Only a Kohen could be a Kohen, right? No matter how great you are, if you're not born a Kohen, you cannot be a Kohen. Malchus belongs to David HaMelech and his children. The only keser that belongs to every single Jew that has the koach, it's a very democratic distinction, that has the koach to acquire, no matter where you were born, how you were born, no matter what your origin, is the keser of Torah. And that's why the keser of Torah is v'yasu, they shall make, meaning every single member of Klal Yisrael has the koach to be zocha to keser Torah. Right? So that's the idea of why it says v'yasu, everything else is v'yasisa. Now, stane ha'ora, there are two symbols, right? What do we say? We say that the Aron HaKadosh represents Torah, and the Menorah represents Torah. Right? There are actually two symbols in the Mikdash, in the Beis Hamikdash, that represent the wisdom of Torah. So why do you need two symbols? So the Nitziv and Chiddush Yerim, they both say the same idea, that the Aron HaKadosh represents Torah Shebichsav. Because literally, it's immutable, it's unchangeable. We even have the phrase, etched in stone. Etched in stone is exactly the Luchais and the Torah Shebichsav. And it is Mechusa in the Aron HaKodesh and the Kodesh HaKodashim, as if to say, we really cannot understand what it says. The Menorah, by contrast, represents Torah Shebaal Peh in a lot of ways. Number one, it comes from human effort, because we have to squeeze the olives, clean the menorah, etc. Number two, it's ever-changing. Right? If you look at a flickering candle, it does not stand still. The flame goes back and forth. There are different colors. There are different textures. And therefore, the menorah represents what we call the dynamism and the creativity of Torah. Now, this is an important thing. We've talked about it many times, and that is we sometimes, maybe especially in our Sameach, we sometimes have an overly static idea of what is Torah Shebaal Peh, as if to say, Hashem gave Moshe every single word. Now, that can't be true. I mean, when you read a daf of Gemara, so Abaya says something, and Rava argues, and somebody else asks Akasha. Now, if you're going to say that this work is simply recounting what Hashem already gave to Moshe, then it's as if to say Abaya is reading a script. Okay, Abaya, you're supposed to stand here and ask a question and look perplexed. And you, Rava, are to aggressively, schlug it up. Obviously this is not play acting. I mean, there's no comparison. What the Tanaim and Amoraim are, there's no way we could possibly compare ourselves. But the truth of the matter is, what Abaya and Rava did, is the same thing you're doing with your chavrusa. It's the same thing. Yeah, they're a gazillion times greater than us, but it's the same process. They're using their minds, they're using their head, they're using their logic, and their dayresh v'chayker to try to come to the emes. This was not something Hashem told Moshe. This is something Abaya is figuring out, and it's something Rashi is figuring out, and it's something Taisus is figuring out, and it's something Rav Yashiv is figuring out, something that you're figuring out. So what do we mean? It's just simple. What do we mean by the idea that everything was given to Moshe B'Sinai? I mean, we do believe that. Everything was given to Moshe. So we mean that Moshe, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Moshe the general principles by which all halacha can be decided. But Hashem did not give Moshe the particular rulings, except when it's halacha Moshe M'Sinai. When something is halacha Moshe M'Sinai, and the Rambam writes there's only like 50 of them, those refer to specific things Hashem gave Moshe. But other than that, Hashem gave Moshe, for example, the 13 principles of interpretation. But then the Chachamim used those interpretations to extract halachas.
How many rules are in the Gemara? Is it 13 or is it something like more?
Are you talking about drushas?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're more than 13. The question is what's exactly the significance? I mean, a very simple thing, a very common drusha the Gemara makes is to take an extra word or letter and say it's coming to teach me something. Well, which of the Yud Gimel Midos is that? There actually isn't. So there are more than the 13. There are actually 32, at least 32 Midos of Drush. So the point is, when we say every word was given to Moshe B'Sinai, we are not referring to things like every word of the Gemara or every word. I once heard a guy say, again, he was very well intentioned, he believed every word of the Mishnah Berurah was given by Hashem to Moshe, and it was handed down from generation to generation until in the time of the Chafetz Chaim, which was in danger of being forgotten. So the Chafetz Chaim wrote it. Again, I mean, that's absurd. But you understand, when we say everything was given to Moshe, we mean all of the principles that are by which every single conceivable matter of halacha can be decided was given to Moshe M'Sinai, but it was left to the Chachamim to apply it. And that is why this answers a very simple question. People ask the question, how is it shaykh for there to be a machlokas? If we believe that the oral law is an unbroken, accurate transmission, then how can one person say kosher, one person say treif, one person say chayev, one person say pater? And the Gemara even says both are right. Elu v'elu divrei elokim chayim. The answer is, and what did Hashem say? The answer is, on most of those machlokim, Hashem said nothing at all. Hashem gave him methodology. He left it to the Chachamim. And whatever the Chachamim come up with, Hashem says is good enough. And even when they get the answer wrong, that's the Gemara in Bava Metzia, that there's a principle of Lova Shemayim. Meaning, Hashem says, I want my will to be interpreted by how the Chachamim understand it, even if in some mathematical sense they got it wrong. It's right even when it's wrong. Now, seen in this way, you can understand why the Menorah is a symbol of Torah Shebal Peh. Fixed. It's ever-changing. It's dynamic. It moves. Now, I understand that what I'm saying might be called a dangerous idea. It's dangerous in the sense that, you know, it can justify, God forbid, reforms, you know, evolution, changes. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, one has to understand who has the authority to do this and what are the parameters, and there are rules regarding that as well. But provided one is working within the framework of those rules of halacha, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants the Chachamim to be the implementers of Torah. So unlike the Torah Shebichtav, which can never be changed in any possible way, and that's why it's the Luchais, the Aron HaKodesh, the Torah Shebal Peh represents dynamism and creativity within that framework. Yeah.
So was there no machloikas up until Anshei Knesset Gedolah?
So here's the thing. So let me make an earlier point. Now the question is, why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu give the Torah that way? Because the Chora, that means HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Torah in a very messy way. He gave the Torah by giving Moshe a written text and some fundamental rules, and then he leaves it to us to figure out the implications. And there's going to be machlokes, there's going to be uncertainty, there's going to be confusion, and machlokas occurs to this very day. I don't mean negative machlokas. I don't mean sinas chida. I'm just talking about machlokas of halacha. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have given Moshe a Torah where every single question had a definitive answer. And if you're going to say, well, maybe 3,000 years ago, they wouldn't have understood what cloning was. So Hashem could have said, open up certain envelopes, and 57, whatever it is, 69, open up an envelope, oh, cloning, surrogate motherhood, atomic energy, land for peace. No, Netanyahu can open up a letter from Hashem that would say about Gush Katif and everything else, instead of having a machlokas haposkim and the like. And the short answer is, this was Hashem's love for Am Yisrael, that he wanted us to be co-creators of Torah, not just passive recipients. A marshal is, like I mentioned the marshal before, so forgive me for repeating it. Let's say a parent wanted to make a cake for a child. Now, if you wanted to make a neat cake, a cake without trouble, the best thing to do is when the child is asleep or in kindergarten, make the cake. But a deeper way of showing love is to involve the child in the making of the cake. Now, the cake is going to be messy. The kitchen will be a mess. It'll be eggshell and sugar and chocolate, and it'll be lumpy and maybe burnt on one side and underdone on another side, and it's not going to be even. It's not as perfect as could have been the case. But there is love in the relationship. And I'm not being irreverent when I say that Torah Shebo'al Peh is a messy process. Now, yes, it is a logically rigorous process, to be sure. But since human logic itself is sometimes messy, and obviously we have a Gemara in which, Torah Shebo'al Peh generally, in which there's machloksim and uncertainties and everything is a matter of different interpretations, it certainly does not have the definiteness and the clarity that we could have had had HaKadosh Baruch Hu just given us the answers. But Hashem says, I want Torah to come from you and me together, and not just coming from Hashem. Okay, so that's an important idea of Torah Shebo'al Peh. That's why we have the two symbols. Now, according to what I'm saying, machlokas, in some sense, is actually a good thing. It's part of the dynamism. It's part of the fact that Hashem wants us to be the creators of Torah. So you could ask me a question. Well, the Gemara indicates that until the time of Hillel and Shammai, there was really no machlokas. Maybe only one case. There was no machlokas in Am Yisrael. Everything got resolved. And it was only from Hillel and Shammai onwards, because people were not mishamish their rebbes properly, that we have all sorts of machlokas. But I would say this. This is my answer. My answer is, there was always machlokas. But what the Gemara means to say was that there was machlokas, but the Sanhedrin was able to be machriya. So you had a Sanhedrin of 71, so you always had machlokas, but the Sanhedrin would then come to a clarity and vote by 36 to 35, and they would be machriya the halacha. What happened at the time of Hillel and Shammai was that because there was a lack of clarity, they could not even come to a majority vote. People were mesupik, and therefore the Sanhedrin themselves... See, I misspoke a moment ago. The Sanhedrin generally did not decide things by 36 to 35. The Sanhedrin decided things by consensus. By that I mean that when there were different dais, they would discuss, and as a body they would come to a conclusion. When it was a 36-35, I don't mean a particular case. When you're judging a particular person, you got to take a vote. I'm not referring to adjudication. I'm referring to paskening halacha. When it came to a psak halacha, if the Sanhedrin saw that the chiluke deis were very strong and there were strong arguments for each side, the derech klal, the chachamim, were not machriya, and they would leave it to Talmidim to follow their rebbes. So the Talmidim of Shammai followed Shammai. The Talmidim of Hillel followed Hillel. They didn't create a situation where they could artificially make a vote. Oh, you lost because to 35. So that represented a yerida. The concept of, even after discussion, not being able to come to a hachra, that is indeed a yerida. But the musag of machlokas, in which people see different sides of things, and they argue in swara, and they argue in precedent, and they utilize their logic, that is really the essence of the kayach of Torah Shebo'al Peh. Okay, so
what did the Sanhedrin do?
Huh?
What did the Sanhedrin do?
Well, in other words, essentially they often abstained, meaning it was kind of a notion where, if indeed there are different chachamim, we're not going to paskin. In other words, they didn't paskin every issue. They basically felt that we should let it go to local autonomy, local leadership, local gedolim, let the talmidim follow their rebbeim, etc. They did not always find a nefitzus to be machriya every single halacha from the time of Hillel and Shammai onwards.
They kind of allowed it in, almost.
That's correct. They allowed a diversity of practice.
And so something fundamentally changed at the time of Hillel and Shammai. I mean, before Hillel and Shammai, everything was decided, every halacha was decided.
That seems to be it. They were because they came to a consensus. And Hillel and Shammai, there was a Yerida called Leishimshu Kol Sarchem. Right, so this is kind of the meaning of the Menorah. Okay, but let's go back to the symbols of the Mishkan itself.
Just when you see a drasha in the Gemara, let's say, whoever, Moira is saying a drasha, is it always that he's saying Misfara, this is how I'm using the meaning? Could he ever be quoting his grandfather or his... Or this was always a Masorah, meaning the drushas sometimes have a Masorah as well?
Well, usually when an Amira says a drusha, an Amira is usually using the drusha to explain an earlier halacha in the Mishnah. So when an Amira is making a drusha, the Amira is apparently at least making the argument that this is what the Tana did. Now, the question you can ask is, how does the Amora know this is what the Tana did? Does the Amira have a Masaira that this is what the Tana did? Or is the Amira using his logic to say, this is what I think logically is the basis of the Tana? That's one question. Another question is, no matter how you interpret what the Amira is doing, let's assume the Amira is right, either because the Amira is guessing this is what the Tana did, or the Amira knows this is what the Tana did. Did the Tana, whom said this halacha, create the drasha? Or was there a Masorah in the drasha itself? So the Rambam is mashma. Now, the first question I can't answer for sure because I don't know. I don't know if the Amira had a Masorah that this was the drasha, or the Amira is saying in Svara this was the drasha. But, be it as it may, at whatever point the halacha had its origin, the Rambam says drashas are chidushim, meaning to say drashas were not Nimshul Moshe Misinai, but rather the Chacham or the Sanhedrin looks at the lashon of the Torah Shem Bechsav and they make drushas.
Could a Tana be quoting his grandfather's drusha?
It's possible. You know, it is possible. Certainly.
Is it? I'm just asking. Is it always his?
Not always. Not always. Because I guess you have to. But I guess it would very much depend who is the author of the halacha. Meaning to say, in other words, put aside the drusha. Tana says a halacha. So, was this halacha in existence the day before he said it? In other words, if he's mentioning a halacha that had already been in existence, then we would assume the drasha had already been in existence. If, on the other hand, it's a new situation in which he's poskening for the first time, then the drasha would be a chiddush as well. And again, this explains the idea of machlokas. So why is it shaycha machlokas? People ask the question, how can there be an argument if everything came from Hashem? The answer is no. Hashem gave the midos, and the Chachamim differ, how to apply the Midos, how to apply Svara, whatever it is. Okay. Now let's go back to the Aron, though, as the symbol of Torah. And we know that one of the halachas in the Torah, this is one of the 613 mitzvahs, is the Badei HaAron, the staffs of the Aron, or the staves of the Aron, as they put it, cannot be removed from the Aron, even when the Aron is at rest in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. This is a lav. Lo yasuru mimenu. The Badei HaAron cannot be removed. In point of fact, this is Malkus. If I remove the Badei HaAron from the Aron, I get Malkus. It's a love. So what is the symbolism of this? So the Chafetz Chaim says very beautifully that the symbolism of Badei HaAron is the Aron represents Torah. Again, he doesn't go with the Torah Shem Bechsav thing. And the Badei HaAron represent those who support Torah. Right? The Badim support the Aron. And you support Torah in different ways. It's important to understand. Of course, one supports Torah by money. But one also supports Torah by valuing it, by giving emotional encouragement, by respecting Talmidei Chachamim, by respecting Bnei Yeshiva. that's considered to be an aspect of Machzikei Torah. And we know that the greatness of Yisachar and Zebulun was Yisachar was the Shevet that was primarily devoted to Torah, and Zebulun was devoted to business and commerce, and Zebulun utilized his resources to help Yisachar, and we say in Olam Zebulun and Yisachar are Shutvim. Now Zebulun had to learn too. There's no such thing as being putter from learning. But still, some people are zocher to learn the whole day, and some people are only zocher to learn part of the day, but nevertheless, they have a great zechus called Machzikei Torah. So the Chafetz Chaim says, the Badei Ha'arin represent Machzikei Torah. And the Lo Yasuru Mimenu connotes that even when the Arin, that are the Talmidei Chachamim, is at rest, means getting its final reward in Olam Haba, Lo Yasuru Mimenu, the Badei Ha'arein are never to be removed from them. They carried the Ark in this world. They carried it. They will be with the Ark in the world to come when the Ark is at rest. Now here, of course, there's the famous word of the Chafetz Chaim. If you remember, you know, Yaakov's struggle with the angel of Esav. So the angel of Esav wanted to destroy Yaakov, and after a long struggle that lasted the whole night, Yaakov wins. Yaakov wins the struggle, but Yaakov is limping. So the Chofetz Chaim has 2 points about this story. Point number one is, why do we only find in the case of Yaakov that an angel tried to destroy him? We don't find that an angel tried to destroy Avram and Yitzchak. And the Chofetz Chaim says, we know that Pirkei Avos says that the world stands on 3 pillars. It's actually Shimon HaTzadik says, right? Al Shleisha Devarim Ha'olam Omeid Al HaTorah V'Al HaAveda V'Al Gemilas Chasadim, the study of Torah, divine service, and loving kindness. The Mefarshim tell us each of the Avos represents one of those fundamental pillars. Avram represents the pillar of Chesed, and Yitzchak, who was a korban, represents the epitome of avoda. And Yaakov, who spent 14 years in the yeshiva of Shem V'Aver, represents the kayach of Torah. So actually, the trajectory is not Torah avoda gemilas chasadim; it's gemilas chasadim avoda Torah. So Memela, the Chafetz Chaim says the following: the sorrow shel Esav on some level is an embodiment, is a manifestation of the Yetzer Hara, the koach of evil in the world that tries to destroy Kedusha. But the Yetzer Hara is a very cunning type of entity, meaning he will allow Jewish people, or anybody, to do good things as long as it's batuach that those things are going to self-destroy and not perpetuate. Sarah Shel Esav is perfectly willing to let Avraham Avinu and his descendants be Osek in Chesed, because Chesed without Torah is ultimately going to collapse. He's perfectly willing to let them do divine service, build magnificent synagogues, because there is no intergenerational continuity. It is Yaakov that he wants to destroy, because once there is the koach of Torah in Am Yisrael, Torah allows there to be a hamshacha, a continuation. And that is why he tries to destroy the koach of Torah, because when you destroy Torah, there will be no Jewish people in the long run. And again, the history of America bears this out very, very clearly. You know, the first immigrants to the United States primarily were involved in social welfare institutions. They built hospitals, fraternal lodges, cemeteries, sure, you know, form of a chesed, obviously, and even country clubs. They wanted to have, you know, their own Jewish, because they couldn't get into, they couldn't get into non-Jewish country clubs, and indeed, the German Jews who came first really hated the Polish and Russian Jews, so they wouldn't allow them to get into their country clubs, so there had to be the Polish and Russian country clubs as well. And of course, their children were largely not religious at all. And then you had the next generation that built magnificent synagogues. They don't build shuls like this anymore, but in the 1920s, whatever, that was the age of the magnificent stained glass synagogue in the United States. Now, almost all of those synagogues today are churches. They are in the inner city areas, and you can walk by, and they're Baptist churches. And some Jewish symbols they couldn't get rid of totally. They still sometimes still see the Aseret HaDibros in Hebrew, still there. The again, the lost generation. To whatever degree religious life has remained in the United States, it's really a product of post-World War II, where they started day schools, you know, Gedolim, Kinvar, and Kutzelkeim, other visionaries of Shraga Feigelman and Lubitsch, and they started day schools, Torah Amsorah, which is a remarkable achievement. Every Jewish community in the United States with 5,000 or more Jews has some day school. You know, even though many of them are near bankruptcy, but they're there. And then yeshivos, and then kollelim. And listen, I'm not going to say that life is a total oasis. There's still so many Jews who are not connected to Yiddishkeit. But certainly in the United States and in other countries which have done the same thing, you do have a core of committed religious Jews, and they will go on and they will grow. The truth of the matter is, the only branch of Judaism that is growing, you know, there's all sorts of demographics that the Jewish people are shrinking. We're shrinking because our birth rates are low. We're shrinking because of assimilation, because of intermarriage, because of people who are no longer identifying themselves as Jews. So the Reform movement is shrinking. Why should I be a Reform Jew? I can be a Goy. It's easier than even being a Reform Jew, whatever it is. So even demographically, the only segment of the Jewish people that is growing in numbers is religious Jews. Both because the birth rate is higher, although that depends on Hasidisha, Litvisha, Modern Orthodox, it's an interesting demographic, and also because people are moving. In other words, what's happening to the conservative and reform movement is they're losing on both ends. They're either losing people to assimilation and secularization, or, Baruch Hashem, they're losing people because people are becoming Bali Tshuva. So the movements are bleeding on both their sides. One side is good, one side is not so good, but nevertheless, that's what's happening. So the Chofetz Chaim Tainis, it is only through the koach of Limud HaTorah that you get intergenerational continuity, which is why the Soro Shel Esav was so adamant to destroy Yaakov. But at the end of the day, or the end of the night, he couldn't destroy Yaakov. But the Chofetz Chaim quotes the Zohar that he had a partial victory over Yaakov. He smote Yaakov on the thigh. The Chofetz Chaim quotes the Zohar that says the thigh are those who support Torah. Just as the thigh supports the body, the machzikei Torah support Torah. So the curse of the angel of Esav is that the financial support of Torah will always be precarious and weak. And that's why yeshivos suffer. And not kidei kach, that the Chofetz Chaim asserted that any Jewish maysad that does not have financial problems, one must question the amitas, the authenticity of its mission. If you're doing well, there's something wrong with you. Because the victory of the angel of Esav is that Yaakov will be limping. He couldn't take Torah away from Am Yisrael. Because there will always be Yechidim, albeit, who will learn Torah even if they're starving. Maybe not a large number. But there are people that will be much no matter what. He did not have the ability to take Torah away from Am Yisrael. But he had the ability to make it rough. So, I want to remind you that, Baruch Hashem, you're in a very, very good yeshiva, because we have all of our money problems. So, we meet the standard admirably. Now, you might say, well, what does that mean? Hashgafically. So, somebody comes to me to support Torah. So what if my response is, you're supposed to suffer. I'm not supposed to help you. This was God's decree when Yaakov was limping and the angel of Esav smote him. So our answer is, it's very similar in the 19th century when a Christian theologian, when anesthesia was introduced for childbirth, there were Christian theologians who said that women were not allowed to take anesthesia, because since Hashem's curse to Chava was Be'esev tel dibanim, you will give birth with pain, so a woman has to suffer. Now, I said these are Christian theologians, because in Jewish halacha there was never such an idea. A curse connotes the natural way Hashem made the teva. The natural teva is that indeed childbirth is going to be painful. But we are permitted and indeed commanded to try to alleviate the negative aspects of that. We're allowed to take medicine. We're allowed to take painkillers. We're allowed to take anesthesia. So the same thing here. Hashem may have said that it is the nature of Hachzakas Torah that there are going to be difficulties. But he also gave us a mitzvah to try to do what we can to alleviate those difficulties. So that's the idea of the Badei Ha'arain. Those are the Machzikei Torah. Now let me mention another thought of the Kli Yakar. That's a very beautiful thought. The Kli Yakar points out that the dimensions of the Arayin are all in fractions. 1.5, 2.5. These are called Midos Shevurov, broken dimensions. When you look at the Midos of the Shulchan, the golden table where we put the Lechem upon it, so you find some of the Midos are whole, and some of the Midos are fractions. So the Kli Yakar gives the following explanation. Again, the Aron represents Torah learning, Torah knowledge, Torah learning. When it comes to Torah knowledge and Torah learning, you should always feel incomplete. You should always feel you don't have enough. There's never a concept of Sameach b'chelkei, I'm happy with what I have. Right? Person might say, Ezeyah Asher, who's wealthy, Sameach b'chelkei, Baruch Hashem, I'm happy with the amount of Torah that I know. I don't have to know more. Especially since, you know, listen, if you're Gaiva, you could truthfully tell yourself, right now, that you know more Torah than 75% of the Jews in the world. That's a pretty big accomplishment right now. Right? So why do I have to learn? I mean, I'm way ahead of almost everybody, every Jew in the world. The answer is, when it comes to Ruchnius, HaKadosh Baruch Hu expects us, we're not in competition with other people. HaKadosh Baruch Hu expects us to know and learn and grow as much as we can. Now, there actually is a concept of Sameach B'chelko in the sense that one should get great joy in what they're learning, meaning one shouldn't feel bad, oh, I only know this, and I don't know. In other words, one needs to get tremendous joy in every Pasuk, every Rashi, every Mishnah, and one should not pull themselves down, but you can't be complacent. You know, you're not the Sameach B'chelko that says, oh, that must be, I know enough. I'm not going to be a rabbi anyway, you know, as parents often say. You're not going to be a rabbi, you know, what do you have to know? The answer is, you know, if you're not going to be a rabbi, maybe you need to learn more because, you know, a rabbi has, you know, more time in the day to learn, maybe. If you're going to be an accountant, you need Badavka to learn more and more. So, the Kli Yakar says, the reason why the Midos are Shavuros, is that in Torah learning, I should always feel I'm incomplete, broken. Now, the Shulchan represents the idea of parnasa, because what do you put on the shulchan? 12 loaves of bread that were the lechem apanim, and they were baked on Friday, they were put on the shulchan on Shabbos, they were left there till next Shabbos, when they were removed, eaten by the kohanim, and new chalos would replace them. By the way, the word chalos is a little misleading. When you think of chalos, you think of big loaves of bread. The lechem apanim were matzah, they were not chametz. They were matzah, but they were a tefach thick, very thick matzah, but if you're thinking, gee, a tefach thick of matzah, it would be like eating a block of granite. It would be like eating concrete. My teeth would break. No, but they were actually soft, spongy matzah. Have you ever seen that? Smarty matzah. Soft, spongy matzah can be made. It looks like pizza, but technically it did not ferment. It did not become chametz. Ashkenazim have a tradition not to do it simply because it's too risky. In other words, Ashkenazic, what you call matzah, flat, hard, brittle matzah, is really because we want to keep so far away from chametz that we kind of burn it black. and stretch it very thin. Svardim are a little more, they're more risk takers, so they're willing to follow the guidelines not to make it chametz, and they make spongy matzah. In the time of the Torah, there's no, the different menachos that were made, which have to be matzah, were spongy and edible in that way. Even the Hillel sandwich, the famous Hillel sandwich, right? You really can't have that much of a sandwich with matzah and maror. You know, it just breaks and crumbles. But the Hillel sandwich was a shawarma, no question, because he had a shawarma and a lafa. It was exactly that because he had the Korban Pesach lamb, roast lamb, and the maror. That's the romaine lettuce. Imagine the lettuce there, and the pita or the shawarma that was wrapped, or the lafa that was wrapped around it. So Hillel invented the shawarma, actually, or the gyro, if you want to be whatever it is, but be this it may. So we say if the Aron HaKodesh represents Torah, the Shulchan represents Parnassa, right? It was a mitzvah Parnassa, and that's why the Gemara actually says, if you want to dive in for wisdom, you should turn to the south because that's the menorah, the light of Torah, in the Beis Hamikdash. And in the Mishkan, the menorah was to the south. If you want to pray for Parnassa, you turn to the north, because that was the Shulchan. You see, that was the Shulchan.
So what does that mean? Meaning you're facing the question?
So the question becomes this. I mean, L'chaira, there's another halacha, that wherever you are in the world, you're supposed to face Yerushalayim. And in Yerushalayim, you're supposed to face the direction of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So that's, whether that's north or south, depends on where I am. But I mean, I have to face that direction. So what do we mean about north or south? So the Rishonim explain that certainly your dominant direction should be in the direction of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. But if you could incline it in a northern way or a southern way. In other words, if you're, let's say, east, let's say in the United States, right, an Aron HaKodesh is supposed to be oriented to the east. It's an interesting question, why we ignore the other direction. I mean, it's interesting. That's a typical, I mean, not every shul does it right, but the typical psak for a Beis Knesset is that an Aron HaKodesh should be aligned due east, straight east. Now, the emphasis is the United States is not directly west of Eretz Yisrael. The United States is northwest of Eretz Yisrael. Is that correct? Not all the United States, but let's say New York. New York is northwest.
Is it more west than north?
Yes, it is more west than north. So that's why east is the dominant direction. What I'm saying is, but we in other words, we look at the dominant direction and we ignore the slant. We don't dive in southeast. We dive in east. So what the Gemara is suggesting is that if you're davening east, if you need Parnassa especially, you need northeast. North of east. And if you need, if you want Torah wisdom, you do it slightly south of east. Right? As opposed to due east. Now, obviously that's not going to work, let's say, if you're due north, right? Then you have to go due south, you know, etc. But on the east-west continuum, you can slant to the north or slant to the south. So we say, Menorah represents Torah, and so does the Aron. And Shulchan represents Parnassa and economic sustenance. So here the Kli Yakar says beautifully that when it comes to wealth, you should always be happy with what you have. That's why part of the midos are complete. Sameach b'chelko. You don't need more? And why are some fractions? That teaches me you shouldn't indulge to the maximum of your resources. Meaning to say, be happy with what you have as if you have everything you need. And don't indulge to the fullness of your taibas. That's why some of them are shavuros, and some of them are shleimos. He offers with this a very interesting explanation of a Gemara in Brachos. When the Gemara in Brachos talks about prayer, the Gemara in Brachos says that a person's eyes should be looking below him, and his heart should go up, meaning I'm looking down in submission and humility, but my heart is praying to Hashem. The Kli Yakar offers a different translation, Derech Drush. Einayim, my eyes, is the gashmias I see in the world. I see wealth and taiva with my eyes. I see all the houses people have, the money they earn, the cars they have. So when it comes to what you see with your eyes, which is gashmias, always look at the people who are worse off than you. Meaning, don't look at the richer people and be jealous of them. Look at the people below you and say, Baruch Hashem, I have everything I need. The leif, which is the understanding of Torah, always look at the people who are greater than you. Don't look at the people below you and say, oh, Baruch Hashem, I know a lot more than them. Look at the people who are greater than you. Right? That's how he learns, Einayim, Einayim Lamayla. Okay? So that's kind of the symbolism of why the Shulchan is Shavuros and Shleimos, and the Aron is only Shavuros. Okay, we'll stop here and see you.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you.